Let's start with robots. This is Zora.
Tonight for dinner, it will be a vegetable soup.
Sparkling conversation is not really her thing, but as you'll hear, she's very highly regarded by residents of the Colony Club in Florida. Zora is a humanoid robot, deliberately made to look a bit human, sound a bit human, and cue very human responses. She's doing what has traditionally been a human job in an aged care facility. Ian Wiley from Management Today has been tracking the rise of the robots at work.
Well, I think we're already seeing the evidence of robots at work. Let's take a step back and think about what we're already used to in terms of when we do our everyday shopping and banking. You know, we think nothing now of going to a grocery store and paying for our groceries using a scanner or doing our banking. I'm just about to pay in a check. I'll do it at my bank, but I won't interact with anyone other than an automated teller. So we're already using that technology, and now we're in the not too distant future. We're talking about, you know, the idea of self-driving cars, and we're using smartphones that talk to us and give us guidance. So I think we're already there. The technology is there. I think, Richard, the question is, are we ready to adopt it?
Let me ask a different question then. What's about to happen, do we think?
Well, there's a very well-known study by a couple of academics at Oxford University, Carl Frey and Michael Osborne. Their research has been the basis for predictions that in the next 20 years, 35% of jobs here in the UK, and then almost half, 47% of jobs in the US, are likely to be susceptible or automated or computerized in some way or other. And then there's another study by the McKinsey Global Institute that predicts that in the next 10 years, robots could jeopardize between 40 million and 70 million jobs worldwide. So we're talking about huge change. To put it into some kind of context, that they're calling it the fourth industrial revolution. That's after steam, mass production, and electronics. So we're talking about profound changes in the way we live our lives and the way we do our jobs.
You must be just as aware of this, Ian, as I am. You mentioned the Oxford study. It is well known. The McKinsey research is out there. And yet, I do not think that most people are aware of this. It's somehow got past most people.
You know, it creeps up on us. The reason I started looking at this area of robotics was for the magazine that I work for. We were celebrating a 50th anniversary. And so we began to look back, first of all, before we looked forward. And if you think about the world of work in the 1960s, you know, many jobs involved physical labor. You know, staff smoked in the office. Tea ladies came out with their little trolleys mid-morning. You know, most women stayed at home. They didn't have a degree. So our workplaces have changed profoundly in the last 50 years. So there's no reason to believe that they won't change even more profoundly in the next 50 years. But we don't notice it happening, do we, until we step back, reflect, look back, and then look at the technology and what's possible.
Let's talk about some of the specifics. So AI, artificial intelligence, it's already becoming important in areas like high finance, but not only there.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think there are some obvious areas where automation, AI, is going to have you know, the largest impact. I mean, there's little doubt that robots or chatbots, as we call them, these sort of super intelligent assistants that can converse in complex and unstructured formats, they're going to turn industries like the customer services industry upside down. We've already got big companies like Unilever, BMW, using these sort of simple Q&A chatbots to answer most of the questions that a customer services employee or agent would be able to answer right now. And then you think about other sectors like the hospitality sector. Just last year, there was a hotel opened in Nagasaki in Japan. It's fully staffed by robots, from from the agents who check you in, to the porters, to the concierge that will give you guidance, completely staffed by robots.
See, I think that in a way, is a very profound example. Because it's fine when it's software, when you're interacting on a screen or even via your mobile with software, and you've got a voice telling you something or instructions on the screen. But you are talking really about physical interactions, not virtual interactions. This is physical service we're talking about.
That's right. That's what makes us sit up and take notice of the change that's happening when we see technology taking on more of those human, those roles that we've assumed that would always be done by a human. So here in Europe, we've got a company in Belgium making a robot called Zora. And Zora is a very lifelike little robot, just 57 centimeters high. And she, I don't know how to describe her. She, I suppose, you know, she's already entering occupations such as social care and nursing and medicine. These are areas that we, I think, until recently assumed would be the preserve of humans. And yet they're able to do these caring type functions.
Well, absolutely we did. In fact, that's been something that I must have read on a dozen occasions, that we will always prefer to be looked after by other humans and that you won't be able to get anything that can do what a human can do. But Zora can do quite a bit, I think.
That's right, Richard. There's a nursing home in Florida, and Zora robots are very active there. They work alongside the human care staff, but they can do some of the more mundane functions, such as taking some of the residents out for a walk. They can perform little dances with them. And I guess it just frees up the normal care staff to do perhaps some of the more important, interactional, more sensitive work that needs to be done.
Do we know how the residents of that home respond to the robots? Because obviously it would be impossible if the robot was freaking them out.
As far as I understand it, the residents enjoy the interaction with the Zora robots. Of course, it's only a small part of their day that they interact with these robots. I imagine if they saw no one but a robot from, you know, 8 in the morning until 8 at night, then that would be a different scenario.
Something else that you discovered, Ian, I found actually kind of disturbing, and that is that the human hand, which one thinks of as a wonder of evolution, with its sort of movement and flexibility and dexterity, that somebody has built a robotic hand that can do most of what we can do.
That's right. I met this company and the founder of this company just a few months ago. It's a company here in London called Shadow Robot. And because I think, as you rightly point out, Richard, replicating the dexterity and flexibility of the human hand, it's one of the great challenges, I guess, for people involved in robotics. But this company, they've built this hand, it's a prototype, so it doesn't look particularly hand-like, but it's able still to mimic most of the actions of the human hand. So when I was there, they demonstrated how it could lift a crystal glass of whiskey. We made sure it wasn't very expensive whiskey, but still it was able to lift the glass of whiskey and manipulate it. And they're already trialing this hand in workplaces like professional kitchens, where it's able to perhaps pick up objects like knives and do simple actions, well, simple to you and me, actions such as chopping a vegetable. But for robotics professionals, this is quite a significant feat. And again, it just, I think, opens a door to a whole new avenue of work that we perhaps assumed robots wouldn't be able to enter.
Yeah. Now, historically, we know that revolutionary technologies have gotten rid of a range of occupations. One thinks of, you know, buggy whip makers at the dawn of the motor car. They all went. That is going to happen this time, isn't it?
For sure. I mean, there will be profound changes in the types of job that are automated, and so therefore they're taken away from humans. But I think on the upside, and I'm trying to be optimistic in my my reading of the future here, I think it will also create a significant number of jobs that we simply aren't aware of. More than half of the jobs that are primary school children will be doing in 20 years' time. We don't even know the names for them yet. We haven't even thought of them yet. So, I mean, I think if we do look back through history, Richard, you know, it suggests that in the long run, technology does create more jobs than it destroys. And there's no convincing argument, I don't think that that won't happen here again. I mean, people will say, well, you know, the Googles and the Facebooks and the you know, of this world don't create as many jobs as the GMs, the Fords, and even the Dells. That may be true. So the number of people actually working directly for these technology companies may not replace the number of jobs we're losing in some of the sectors that will see the most impact. But then there are all kinds of indirect multiplier effects. You know, so we see other sub-industries, sub-sectors, suppliers, other linked industries grow and benefit as a result. So I'm hopeful, Richard, that we'll view this, you know, if we're all living in another 100 years' time and we look back at this next industrial revolution, that we'll look back and see that actually it created just as many jobs as it took away.
Well, fingers crossed. Just for those of us who won't be looking back in 100 years, Ian, and at this profound industrial revolution, the ones of us who would just want to get through the rest of our careers, or perhaps people who haven't started theirs yet, what are going to be the ways of perhaps avoiding obsolescence?
Well, I think the first advice I would have is to embrace this change, Richard. I don't think we can avoid it. We can't turn the clock back. We can't put the robots back in their boxes, even if that's what we wanted to do. I think there is a future to be excited about here, but only if we are willing to be flexible and to adapt, not just the jobs that we do, but perhaps the organizations that we work for. So therefore, I think there's a real challenge here for the leaders of our organizations, private sector, public sector, our governments. And I don't think it's about predicting what jobs will be replaced by intelligent machines, but it'll be thinking about how best to harness this march of the robots, to imagine the opportunities that they bring, and to ensure that we make those robots and those AI systems actually work for our people rather than against them. So, you know, I think the organizational leaders who will be successful in this new world will be the ones who combine the robots, the technology, the AI, and their human resources, their people, you know, to create outcomes that benefit their employees, stakeholders, and society as a whole. I think we need our employers to embrace automation in order to create efficiencies, for sure, but also to free up people like you and me to engage in more meaningful, creative, and work that is ultimately more fulfilling.
Well, I'm all for that. Ian, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Richard.
Ian Wiley is a contributing editor at Management Today magazine. This is Best Practice on RN, the ABC Radio app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adie.